Okay, let's go on into the Coastal Habitat Protection Plan. Comments of the Steering Committee from Commissioner Posey. Martin?
Hello. Well, as most of you know, we're undergoing a 5-year review and amendment to the Coastal Habitat Protection Plan. Pete and I are the Marine Fisheries Council representatives to the CHIP Steering Committee, and I have the pleasure of being chair of that committee this year. Just some quick updates. Commissioners, between the last meeting and the current meeting of the CHIP Steering Committee, commissioners reported back to their respective fall commission meetings. Pete and I reported back to y'all at the last MFC meeting. In terms of other meetings, at the November CRC meeting, the Coastal Resources Committee provided some feedback on the submerged aquatic vegetation protection and restoration with focus on water quality issue paper, particularly on areas related to nutrient standard recommendations and the ability to put some of the actions into place. At the December EMC meeting, there were no questions or comments about the update. At our last CHIP Steering Committee, background information was presented for the wetland protection and restoration, was focused on nature-based methods and habitat monitoring to assess status, as well as the habitat monitoring to assess status and regulatory effectiveness issue papers. Those are the issue papers we'll be hearing today. One looking at wetland protection, the other one looking at the habitat monitoring program. The final draft of the inflow infiltration paper was presented to the CHIP Steering Committee at their last meeting, and after some discussion, it was approved. At the last meeting, we also reviewed letters of support for two proposals related to CHIP priority areas. The first proposal, evaluating a tiered approach to inform monitoring, assessment, and decision-making elements for seagrass management and conservation. If approved, we'll focus on establishing high salinity SAV habitat monitoring protocols. This particular proposal was done with or submitted with DEQ partners and specifically addresses action items within the CHIP plan, both in the previous plan and the proposed plan drafts. The second proposal, coastal resilience multi-scale mapping and monitoring to assess vulnerability of North Carolina's coast to sea level rise, will focus on wetland coastal habitat mapping using remote sensing techniques to assess change and coastal resiliency. Once again, this proposal was submitted with DEQ partners and specifically addresses CHIP priority areas. The there any issues to commissioners, an idea was brought up to form a work group that could discuss win-win recommendations that could be accomplished quickly, particularly concerning water quality related issues. One of the things that's come up in a number of discussions is the complexity of water quality issues. There's a desire to sort of look at what areas could be addressed that may be something that a wide variety of stakeholders would be supportive of. And so the idea is to get a work group together to concentrate on some of those components. Discussions about that work group have begun. And our next CHIP Steering Committee will be meeting in April, where we'll be reviewing final drafts of the wetland protection and restoration with focus on nature-based methods, issue paper, as well as the habitat monitoring to assess status and regulatory effectiveness issue paper. So today you're going to hear a presentation on the wetlands protection as well as habitat monitoring issue papers that we reviewed at the CHIP Steering Committee at our last meeting. And that is a quick update. Any questions?
Great. Thank you, Martin. Any questions for Martin? Great. Great presentation. So let's go on over to the 2021 CHIP development update. Ann and Casey Knight.
Good afternoon. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you for that introduction, Commissioner Posey and Mr. Chairman. Today, we're going to continue with what we've been doing and share some background on issue papers that you haven't gotten the background on yet, so that when we come to you with the full draft plan in the fall. You'll have, it won't be so much information all at once. You'll have a background and familiarity with it, and we'll be focusing on the recommended actions. So as Martin said, I'm going to go over background on the wetland protection and enhancement issue paper, and that has a focus on using nature-based solutions as strategies. All right, so for the purposes of the coastal habitat protection plan, coastal wetlands include all estuarine and plustuarine wetlands within the CHIP region. So estuarine wetlands are wetlands that begin in the lower estuary and extend up to about 0.5 parts per thousand salinity. And then plustuarine is the term for the fresher wetlands beyond that. So the map on the right gives you a broad picture of where those estuarine and plustuarine wetlands occur. 95% of North Carolina's wetland acreage for the whole state occurs within a coastal plain. And so because those wetlands occur across a broad range of conditions in terms of salinity and hydro period and proximity to the coast, there are many different kinds. And while there are different types of wetlands, they provide similar ecosystem functions, although some wetland types are better than others at certain functions, or they benefit different fish species. So in this picture, we have the bottom left, there's your typical salt marsh. We have our mesohaline or brackish marsh that we find further up rivers, and then an example of a forested wetland or cypress swamp. So the issue paper will first include updated information on the ecological and economic value of wetlands. So the commission, more than any other, is very aware of the value of wetlands for fishery production, especially for nursery areas. But not only fish, but many other types of animals, like reptiles, amphibians, birds, use these wetlands. And so they're known to be a biodiversity hotspot in the state. One of the important functions that wetlands provide is the water quality filtration. So wetlands represent the first line of defense for trapping pollutants coming from upland runoff. By cleaning the water, they are not only benefiting the fish that live there, but the other habitats that need certain high water quality conditions to survive, as well as human uses such as swimming and shellfish harvest. Flood control is another function that most people don't think about. But a wetland is like a living sponge, and it can store up to 100,000 gallons of water per acre per day. So in heavy rain events, it can really reduce the amount of flooding in town and the runoff that goes into our surface waters. Another function of forested wetlands that not all are aware of is timber production. Forested wetlands can be harvested unless they're on conservation land or too logistically difficult. And this contributes substantially to the coastal economy. As long as the hydrology isn't altered, they can restore themselves and regrow. Another important function is erosion control. Shoreline erosion can be reduced by 50% when the shoreline is vegetated versus unvegetated. And this is based on studies in North Carolina. Those studies have also found that it doesn't take an extensive marsh to do this. Even 7 to 25 meters of marsh will significantly reduce the wave energy. And that provides an economic value to the waterfront property owners. And then fishing, recreation, and tourism, we all know, is very popular on the coast. And the fishing is made better by the wetlands, as is recreation and tourism. There are activities like kayaking, shellfish production is better with wetlands, and fishing, of course, is better near wetlands. And then last, carbon sequestration. So this is when plants take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it by burying it or containing it in their organic matter. And marshes are known to be 30 to 50 times better at this than temperate forests. So just to spend a little bit more time on the fishery importance of wetlands, this is a table showing different wetland-dependent fishery species, some commercially, some recreationally, some both. 90% of commercial and 60% of recreational fishery species are dependent on wetlands for some stage of their life. That clearly indicates the importance of protecting wetlands. Many of these species are among the top 10 species landed commercially or recreationally. If you look at the far right of the table, there's a column for commercial rank and recreational rank. So there are 7 commercial wetland-dependent species that are in the top 10 of the landings based on the DMF data. So if they were, I've added what their rank was in that column. If you don't see a number, that means they weren't within the top 10. But for an example, blue crab, number 1 in commercial landings based on pounds. So there are 7 of those that came in within the top 10. And recreationally, there were also 7 species in the top 10, although they are different species for the most part. So for recreational spotted sea trout was number 1. And that's in terms of number of directed trips, not pounds landed. Together, commercial and recreational fishery values at $3.4 to $4.8 billion a year. So in addition to showing what the value of our wetlands are, the issue paper will summarize what is known regarding their status events. The location and acreage of the different wetland categories is shown in this map and table. The source is NOAA's Coastal Change Analysis Program, or it's called CCAP for short. They categorize the different types of land cover, including different types of wetlands. So you'll see the terms that they use here in this table, and they divide it by palustrine and estuarine, and then by the type of vegetation. So it's forested, shrub, scrub, and emergent. Emergent wetland is just another word for marsh. The herbaceous grasses. So there's a total of 4.6 million acres of wetlands within the CHIP region. The majority of those, you can see from the table and the map, are palustrine. And the palustrine, 70% are forested. And there is a total of 242,000 and something acres of estuarine wetlands. The majority of those are the marsh. So how are the wetlands doing? It's important when you look at that to remember that although the coastal plain does have a lot of wetlands, it was 58% more going back to pre-colonial times. So the pie chart on the left shows you what losses occurred prior to 1950 and those that occurred 1950 to 1990. And though you would think that most of it was very old, 39% of it occurred between the 50s and 90s. Most of the losses were attributed to the conversion for agriculture use and forestry, or in some cases, filling or modification due to the perceived threat of disease back then. So that's why they did mosquito ditching. And the losses that did occur were not evenly distributed. They were primarily the palustrine. We can look in more detail at losses that have occurred in more recent years. So this table is showing the wetland types of the types of palustrine wetlands are in the column. And it's going back 20 years in 5-year increments. And the main point, well, let me The red fields in the table are losses. The green fields are gains. And over that 20-year period, if you go down to the bottom right, you'll see the net loss of wetlands was 134,000 something acres. And most of that, all of that actually came from the forested wetland category. That's why it's all red on that left forested wetland column. So you do see that there's a gain in scrub shrub and emergent wetlands, and that's attributed to the loss of forested was likely due to being cut down for timber. So then that land appears to be scrub shrub or emergent in their imagery. And it can return to forested if allowed time and the hydrology wasn't altered. So the net loss of 134,000 means that there was still overall wetland loss. And that on the right, you can see the amounts. So some of it was converted to development permanently, others to uplands, some to agriculture, and then open water. So open water would represent erosion along the shoreline that becomes water. So now if we look at the estuarine wetlands and trends in the last 20 years, you'll see a large difference. For one thing, the scale is a lot less. So in 20 years, it looks like there's a gain of 448 acres. This again is from the NOAA's CCAP analysis. And they showed that over time, there was a shift in the primary cause of losses from agricultural conversion from 96 to 2006 to development during the 2006-2010 period. And then in this most recent five-year period, it was due to sea level rise and erosion on the shoreline. I just wanted to point out this is based on CCAP analysis of land cover from imagery that has a 30 meter by 30 meter resolution. And so it may not be able to pick up small, narrow bands of marsh. And it could be underestimating change. So there's been discussion, the need to have better resolution imagery to really get a more accurate indication of what's going on with the estuarine wetlands. So next, the issue paper will evaluate what the current and future threats are to wetlands. Impacts for development are one of those threats. We know that impacts are allowed through a permitting process for the 401 wetlands, and there's thresholds. There's low thresholds, but they do add up. The graph here shows how the number of permits for wetland stream buffer impacts has changed since 1990. The cause of the permitted wetland impacts in the coast has shifted over the last 30 years. According to DWR's permit database, in the 90s, most of the impacts were attributed to water-dependent structures like marinas, docks, bulkheads, and dredging. From 2000 to 2010, there was a large increase in impacts from mining. And since 2010, most of the impacts have come from transportation, so DOT roads going through wetlands, that type of thing. Some of these impacts are offset by mitigation, but others aren't. So another concern related to development is regulatory limitations to wetland protection. So I was just going to explain one significant change that happened last year is a revision of the definition of waters of the United States. So that's the acronym for that is WOTUS. So if you hear WOTUS, that's what they're talking about. This is a federal definition. It's included in the Navigable Waters Protection Rule, and it was redefined to exclude certain waters and wetlands due to lack of direct surface water connectivity, mostly ditches and other and other things. So wetlands that did not have a direct, that did not directly abut or have a direct surface water hydrologic connection to the jurisdictional waters were not considered adjacent, and therefore the wetlands are not protected as they once were. An analysis was done in North Carolina on how that would impact wetlands here. And on this slide, you can see the most impacted wetland types would be bottomland hardwood forest, headwood forest, floodplain pools, non-riverine swamp forest, pine flats, bogs, and seeps. This will allow development in those areas that were previously protected, potentially. Loss of these types of wetlands would impact primarily water quality and flood protection, but could also affect wetlands used by fishery species. For the next 20 years, coastal North Carolina's population is expected to increase 16 to 60%. It's likely to impact wetlands. This development is likely to impact wetlands through things like I just showed you, being able to develop on them, but also through shoreline stabilization. So shoreline hardening impacts wetlands by preventing migration landward and also by scouring in front of the vertical structure. So this leads to loss of wetlands over time. And that top right figure is showing a study where they measured and sampled the wetlands in front of a bulkhead that was required to be put landward of the wetland to avoid impacting the wetland, but it still results in the loss of the wetland over time. In 2012, DCM delineated the coastline, the shoreline edge. They identified the vegetation type on that shoreline and any man-made structures. So the table on the left is the breakdown that was provided in that report of how many miles of different shoreline structure types existed at the time of that assessment, which was 2012. And so from that table, you can see the most common structure is bulkheads, and there was, at that time, 497 miles of bulkhead. The second most common structure is riprap, followed by bulkhead with marsh waterward of it, and then bulkhead with sediment bank waterward of it. So as you can see, if we could reduce bulkhead extent and use something that will allow the marsh vegetation to survive longer, such as the living shoreline, which in this table is usually permitted as a marsh sill, and that's what you're seeing in the bottom right figure, then you can protect the shoreline but still maintain wetland fringe for fish and water filtration and all those things. So climate change is also a really serious threat to wetlands, particularly salt marsh. So if sea level increases at a rate greater than marsh can keep up with, they become inundated and drown. Research by NOAA in some areas in North Carolina indicates the marshes are not keeping up. Also, increasing severity and frequency of storms that's associated with climate change is expected to cause increased erosion of the marsh. So if adjacent upland is available, the marshes can migrate inland. However, if there's developed structures, bulkheads, or buildings, they won't be able to. And so climate change impact of sea level rise and erosion in combination with the continued coastal development results in coastal squeeze and marsh loss. And so in summary, what we do know about coastal wetlands is, one, that they are critical for fish, they're critical for other habitats and people. The data that has been done from NOAA indicates that we continue to lose wetlands, and we have lost a significant amount historically. And we know the impacts are likely to increase because the rate of development in the coast is expected to increase, and climate change is going to be co-occurring with that development. And finally, we know that the maps are outdated and not at the resolution needed to really assess where the impacts are occurring the most. So that would be the first step towards strategic planning for wetland protection and restoration. So when we bring you the completed issue paper in the fall, it will also include the discussion on strategies we could take to address wetland loss. So this might be things like planning for marsh migration, targeted restoration where it's most needed to prioritize, additional use of living shorelines and other nature-based solutions, and possibly regulatory changes. So while it does seem like a big issue to tackle, that's one of the concerns we heard from CRC, is that how are we going, you know, climate change, you can't stop climate change, but there are ways that you can reduce the impacts, primarily by planning and then taking action. And so that's all I have for now. There is no action. Just want to make you aware there's action needed at this time. Unless there are any questions, I can turn it over to Casey Knight to go over the other issue paper.
Okay, any questions of Ann? All right, wonderful presentation. So turn us over to Casey, I believe you said. Hey, Casey. You're muted. There you go.
Good afternoon, Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead and get this pulled up.
All right.
All right. Good afternoon, commissioners and listeners. I'm Casey Knight, and I'm a biologist with Habitat Enhancement Section, and I work with all things coastal habitats. Today, I'll be reviewing the background information for the issue paper, Habitat Monitoring to Assess Status, Trends, and Regulatory Effectiveness. This will be included in the amendment of the Coastal Habitat Protection Plan that we know as the CHIP, as you've already gotten a good intro from Commissioner Posey and Ann. There we go. So just a reminder, the legislative goal of the CHIP is the long-term enhancement of coastal fisheries associated with coastal habitats. Within North Carolina's coastal ecosystem, there are six habitat types: what the water column, shell bottom, submerged aquatic vegetation, also known as SAV, wetlands, soft bottom, and hard bottom. These habitats support juvenile and adult populations of an economically important fish species, as well as forest species important to the food chain, while also providing many co-benefits that help support healthy and resilient coastal ecosystems. To achieve this goal, these habitats must be understood and observed repeatedly over time to determine current conditions and assess any changes. This is done through habitat monitoring. Through monitoring, we are able to assess the status and trends of the individual coastal habitats and the coastal ecosystem as a whole. Monitoring is essential given the vulnerability of these habitats to human pressures, including those and those associated with climate change. The understanding of the status and trends is important for making educated management actions and protection and restoration decisions. The following is going to detail the most up-to-date status and trends and the current monitoring efforts for the coastal habitats. The water column is the medium through which all aquatic habitats and the organisms that use them are connected. So it's a pretty important one. The term water quality describes the condition of waters based on select physical, chemical, and biochemical characteristics, usually with respect to a particular purpose, such as drinking, recreation, or supporting aquatic life. Fish species and habitats, such as SAV and shell bottom, exhibit threshold tolerances affecting their distribution and abundances. Conditions of water column that are outside of these thresholds are considered impaired, polluted, or otherwise not supporting aquatic life, or just bad water quality. Basic parameters of water quality impairment include pH, temperature, dissolved oxygen, turbidity, bacteria, nutrient and nutrient indicators such as nitrogen, phosphorus, and chlorophyll A. As illustrated here, excessive nutrient-rich sediment from land-based activities entering the water can increase nutrients in the system, in turn decreasing dissolved oxygen and water clarity and increasing toxic contamination, which can result in algal blooms and fish kills. Climate change will continue to add to these issues with rising sea level, high water temperatures, and increased frequencies and intensities of rain events, adding even more runoff to the systems. The EPA National Coastal Condition Assessment 2010 report found that more than half of the southeast coastal region in their condition based on water quality of the water quality index. In North Carolina, there's approximately 36 stations, with most concentrated in the northern regions, as seen on the map here. Ratings for chlorophyll A and phosphorus contribute to the most to the fair and poor water quality scores. Between 2005, 2006, and 2010, there is a modest increase in the percent area rated good based on the water quality index. A significant increase in the percent area rated good for dissolved oxygen and water clarity, and a small but significant change in nitrogen conditions contribute to the improvement in 2010. So at a regional level, the Southeast is generally trending in the right direction, but there's still a lot of improvements that need to be made. Here in North Carolina, Division of Water Resources regularly assess water quality to determine how well water bodies are meeting their intended uses, as required by Section 303D and 305B of the Clean Water Act. This assessment, known as the Integrated Report, is completed biannually and indicates the general conditions of North Carolina's waters and identifies waters that are not meeting water quality standards. In 2018, North Carolina impaired waters included 16,000 freshwater acres, most of which were found in Albemarle Sound Region 1, CHIP Region 1, about 500 freshwater miles, most of which were found in Pamlico Sound CHIP Region 2, and a little over 600,000 saltwater acres, with most in the Albemarle Sound and Pamlico Sound, CHIPS Regions 1 and 2. DWR's ambient monitoring system, which has been active for over 40 years, consists of a network of stations established to provide site-specific long-term water quality information on significant water bodies throughout the state. This program produces data used in the integrated report, as well as other water quality management activities, including the basin plans, total maximum daily loads, and discharge permit limits. Currently, there are over 300 active stations, about half of which are inside the CHIP boundaries. But stations are concentrated in the riverine and upper estuarine waters. Each station is visited quarterly. For this update or this issue paper, over 20 years of water quality data from representative 18 stations denoted here by the stars on the map were analyzed for general trends. Coastwide, it's an overall trend for increasing nutrients and chlorophyll A in almost every region, especially in upper estuary stations, and increased turbidity during increased wet years, and turbidity is consistently higher in the Roanoke Rivers and North Rivers. As coastal development continues and the effects of climate change are felt, increased nutrient runoff is projected, and it will be cheaper and easier and better to protect and preserve than to restore. And this is especially true of the water column, since it is directly affects the condition and distribution of the other habitats and the organisms that use them. Nutrient-sensitive waters is a supplemental classification intended for waters needing additional nutrient management due to excessive algal growth. Currently, there are no water quality standards for nutrients except for a 10 milligram per liter nitrate for drinking water. Nutrient enrichment is presently measured by chlorophyll A, which is a response in the water column with a standard of 40 micrograms per liter. Four basins in North Carolina carry the supplemental classification of nutrient-sensitive waters. The Chowan River Basin was classified in 1979 with the Nutrient Control Plan in 1982 to reduce phosphorus and nitrogen. Data through 2012 did not indicate increased chlorophyll A levels, but since has increased threefold with a resurgence of concurrent with the resurgence of algal blooms in the basin. The Tar Pamlico River Basin was classified in 1989. The basin has a total maximum daily load goal to meet chlorophyll A standards. Recent nutrient data indicates increases in nitrogen. The Neuse River Basin was classified in 1988 and also has a total maximum daily load. And like the Pamlico, the recent Neuse data indicates a rise in nitrogen levels, specifically organic nitrogen, which is offsetting the decreases in nitrate from the implementation of the total maximum daily loads at the initial implementation. The New River was classified in 1991 with a strategy to reduce point source nutrients in the upper estuary. Data indicates that nutrient enrichment is a continued problem resulting in the exceedance of the chlorophyll A standard. The White Oak River Basin Plan will be completed this year and will include additional water quality assessment and assessments and recommendations to address nutrients in the New River. So while some achievements were made through the initial implementation actions when these waters were first classified, there are still nutrient issues that continue and need to be addressed. In 2019, Division of Water Resources investigated 13 fish kills across North Carolina. In addition, 64 sightings of fish kills and algal blooms were reported by the public on the online tool. And not all of these were confirmed by DWR staff due to constraints of staffing. The number of algal blooms in North Carolina has varied from 2015 to 2019. During this time, the number of reports reached a maximum in 2015 of 50 events and a minimum in 2017 of 25 events. Water quality conditions such as increased nutrients, nitrogen, and phosphorus concentrations, like the increasing trends that I just spoke about that we're observing in the ambient monitoring stations, can result, coupled with high water temperatures and stagnant water flows, can result in these algal blooms. The blooms themselves then increase the pH and increase the pH and decrease the dissolved oxygen in the water, which can result in fish kills and mortality of other organisms within the water column, not to mention the decreased aesthetic value and the overall general displeasure of them. So hopefully, if the increasing nutrient issues are addressed and water quality improves, the algal blooms and fish kills should also decrease. The Shellfish Sanitation and Recreational Water Quality section of the Division of Marine Fisheries is responsible for monitoring and classifying coastal waters as to their suitability for shellfish harvesting and monitoring, and issuing advisories for coastal recreation swimming areas. The section performs sampling at over 1,000 shellfish growing area stations. Shellfish growing areas are surveyed every 3 years to assess existing or potential pollution sources and to determine the hydrographic and meteorological effects that could affect water quality. At least 6 times a year, water samples are collected from each shellfish growing area and tested for fecal coliform bacteria, which is an indicator of the presence of human or animal waste, because nobody wants a food oyster. This information is then used to classify shellfish growing areas. Approved areas are consistently open to fishing and shellfish harvest, while prohibited areas are permanently closed. Conditionally approved areas can be open to shellfish harvest under certain conditions, such as dry weather when stormwater runoff is not impacting the water quality. Area status can change quickly due to closures after rainfall, high numbers during routine sampling, or unexpected pollution events such as sanitary sewer overflows, which is also part of the inflow and infiltration issue that the TIP amendment is tackling this time. Restricted waters can be used for harvest at certain times as long as shellfish are cleaned before they are made available for consumption. And as you can see from the table above, over the years, there has generally been an increase in closed areas with a decrease in open areas, with a slight exception in 2020. Improved land use practices, as well as expanded and increased monitoring, could help keep this trend moving in the right direction. Shell bottom in North Carolina has seen dramatic changes since colonial times. The eastern oyster occupies a unique position in the estuaries of North Carolina because it colonizes because of its colonization of estuarine bottom, creating a productive habitat, and the animal itself being harvested as a food item. Due to the combined effects of habitat destruction, overfishing, disease, and deteriorated water quality, the oyster population has experienced tremendous declines worldwide, particularly within the subtidal oyster reefs that occur along the mid-Atlantic coastline of the United States. A study published in 2011 estimated 85% of oyster reefs have been lost globally. As illustrated in this slide, the oyster population has been actively managed for a very long time. However, it has been done with limited information about the resource. In North Carolina, commercial landings from public bottoms have been variable, but have been in general decline for most of the past century, which was likely initiated by poor harvesting practices, resulting in overharvest and low spawning stock biomass, but also compounded by habitat destruction, pollution, and biological and environmental stressors, including disease and storm damage. However, in the past decade, landings from private bottoms have significantly increased due to more interest in aquaculture. Yet there's still insufficient data to conduct a traditional stock assessment for the eastern oyster in North Carolina, so the exact population size is not known. Shell bottom in North Carolina has been mapped since the late 1900s, but was limited to larger estuaries and has long since become outdated. In the late 80s, DMF began the Shellfish Bottom Survey with the purpose of locating and mapping shellfish producing areas and to delineate potential productive benthic shellfish habitats. In 2019, the mapping of over 500,000 acres of coastal waters, including 22,000 acres of shell bottom, was completed. Most of North Carolina's shell bottom can be found in the southern SHIP regions 3 and 4, the White Oak and Cape Fear River basins. The White Oak River Basin is dominated by subtidal shell, with intertidal shell being dominant in the Cape Fear region 4. These regions were also the more productive of the mapped shell strata, with the highest densities or highest numbers of oysters per square meter. Here's an example of the mapping and the strata delineations. As you can see, without shell stratas are the burgundy and brown colors, with little pockets of the shell strata signified by the pink and or the yellow and pinkish red. You can see here that when you look at the densities of those areas from the sampling, you also see that they're higher densities of oysters, indicating more productive areas. To combat generally declining trends in shellfish, restoration efforts have been ongoing throughout North Carolina estuaries for over half a century. As of 2020, DMF has constructed 15 oyster sanctuaries in the Pamlico Sound, totaling almost 400 permitted acres. Oyster sanctuaries are evaluated annually for densities, size frequencies, and population demographics. North Carolina's oyster sanctuaries have demonstrated the capacity to maintain higher population densities and a greater abundance of large fecund oysters. When compared to unprotected oyster reefs, there is a striking decrease in densities. The average productive potential of oyster sanctuaries can be up to 30 times greater than unprotected reefs. Integrating total reef area and reproductive potential, oyster sanctuaries potentially provide over 25% of all larvae in the system, while only accounting for 1% of the reef area. Many of the sanctuaries within the network are considered stable, with annual fluctuations reflecting recruitment and survivability year to year. Newer oyster sanctuaries like Raccoon Island and Swan Island are still exhibiting large densities of oysters. The continuation and expansion of the oyster sanctuary program with enhanced sighting and material monitoring is incredibly valuable to support the wild oyster population in North Carolina. State-sponsored cult planting in North Carolina began as early as 1915. The North Carolina or the Division of Marine Fisheries cult planting program began in 1947 and has the goal to enhance the oyster fishery. Since standard record keeping began for the program in the 1980s, DMF has planted over 12 million bushels of colch. Oyster recruitment, called spatfall, on newly deployed colch can be an indicator of potential larval availability and recruitment potential. The spatfall data from colch planting sites over the last 31 years indicate a decline in maximum stat fall relative to similar surveys in the 1950s. Looking at data from north and south of Newport River, illustrated here, you can see a decline in the average spat fall in about the mid-1980s, with a rebound in the late 90s to about 2010, at which time the south began to decline while the north continued to increase. Since about 2015, there's been an overall declining trend, with the exception of a slight uptick in the south in the last few years. Researchers suspect that oysters are becoming spawner limited, while others attribute the decline to stress and mortality from infectious disease affecting primarily larger, more fecund adults, or physical damage from oyster dredging, or the indirect effects of poor water quality. Additional monitoring research is needed to understand these trends and increase the suitability of coach planting sites, materials, and methods. So hopefully this will be a review for most of the commissioners from the SAD issue paper background that's been previously presented, but I'll quickly recap. Various mapping and monitoring projects have happened along the North Carolina coast for SAD since the 1980s. These mapping events produced GIS files that, when compiled, make up the historic known extent of SAD and SAD habitat in North Carolina, which is totaled at approximately 191,155 acres. Additional mapping and monitoring of fresh and brackish SAD is ongoing. And as these more current data layers become available, they will be incorporated to better inform this known historic extent and the current extent of SAD and SAD habitat in North Carolina. When SAD beds are impacted directly by physical damage, or indirectly due to poor water quality, large-scale losses can occur. Globally, SAD abundance is declining, with studies showing a 29% decline in the known SAD extent since 1879, and indication of an acceleration of loss since about 1940. SAD is disappearing at rates similar to coral reefs and tropical rainforests. Of the 72 known species of seagrass, 10 are at elevated risk for extinction, and 3 are endangered. The extent of seagrass loss in North Carolina is still being quantified, but indicators are that SAD beds may be less than 50% of what they once were, especially on the mainland side of the coastal sounds. Recent efforts are being made to better quantify these losses and show declines, with the highest percent of declines of about 10%. Occurring from Bard's Inlet to Cape Lookout, Bard's Inlet at Cape Lookout to Bogue Inlet. Higher losses of up to 32% are estimated in the lower salinity areas of Albemarle and Pamlico Sound. These losses need to be stemmed now through increased water quality protection and the promotion of best land use practices before we lose more of this incredibly valuable habitat. Thankfully, Ann covered wetlands very well for us this morning or previously, so we will not cover them again today. Oceanic hard bottom is the primary habitat for offshore marine organisms in North Carolina. Hard bottom in North Carolina is limited to specific areas of the continental shelf, with 90% of the existing hard bottom occurring south of Cape Hatteras. These natural and important areas are susceptible to overfishing due to their scarcity and abundance of inhabitants. The amount of natural hard bottom reefs between Cape Hatteras and Cape Fear has been estimated to be around 500,000 acres, or about 14% of the available substratum. In a 1998 South Atlantic report, nearshore hard bottom was considered to be in good general condition. Although limited information exists on the distribution of the hard bottom off the coast of North Carolina, even littler information is available to evaluate the condition of this hard bottom. Anecdotal information suggests that many nearshore hard bottom sites in the mid-20th centuries are now covered by sand, reducing the abundance of fish in these areas. For example, some hard bottom off the coast of Wrightsville Beach, which is now buried in under 2 to 6 inches of sand due to erosion from some beach nourishment projects. The condition of shallow hard bottom in North Carolina waters is of particular importance to the health and stability of the snapper grouper species that uses it as a protective stopping point as they emigrate offshore. Between 2016 and 2019, the North Carolina commercial snapper grouper fishery harvested an annual average of 1.2 million pounds of fish with an average annual market value of over $4 million. During the same period, recreational fishermen also harvested an annual average of over 1.2 million pounds of fish. And we also have our artificial reef program that helps support, helps to create reefs that support similar ecological communities and functions similar to the nearby natural reefs, which Jason already also covered with us this morning, so I will forego that as well. So soft bottom is our last habitat, and marine sediment constitutes one of the largest habitat types on Earth, covering roughly 80% of the ocean's bottom. Environmental characteristics such as grain size, salinity, dissolved oxygen, depth, and flow conditions affect the condition of the habitat and the distribution of the organisms that use it. The characteristics common to all soft bottom is the mobility of unconsolidated sediment. Soft bottom is in a constant state of flux as other habitats expand and contract. A recent study estimated the global extent of tidal flats to be over 31 million acres and assessed that 16% of tidal flats were lost globally between 1984 and 2016. As part of the strategic habitat area assessment, soft bottom areas have been described for all CHIP regions. Due to variations in temporal and spatial resolution of the GIS data used, the Shaw assessment and the Shaw assessments occurring over a 10-year period and overlapping segments occurring in the inlets in regions 1-2 and regions 2-3. So this is going to be an overestimation of the existing estuarine and marine soft bottom. However, currently it's the best estimate of soft bottom in North Carolina. As expected, the most extensive amounts of soft bottom can be found in CHIP regions 1 and 2, the Albemarle and Pamlico Sound. The deep soft bottom is dominant with at least more than twice the amount of the shallow soft bottom in every region. No targeted mapping efforts exist for soft bottom, and the bathymetry has been outdated. So at this time, it is not possible to quantify the extent of soft bottom habitats as they change through time. The condition of and quality of soft bottom habitat can affect the species abundance and diversity of the benthic community, which in turn can affect the fish assemblage. The 2010 National Coastal Condition Assessment rated the biological quality of 77% of the waters of the southeast coastal region as good based on the benthic index. Based on the sediment quality index, 65% of the southeast coast region was rated good for sediment condition, and sediment toxicity findings indicated that 81% were in good condition. For the ecological fish tissue contamination index, none of the area was rated good. Between 2005 and 2006 and the 2010 report, there was a significant decrease in areas rated good for sediment quality. In North Carolina, studies have shown that sites have higher concentrations of contaminants have lower indices of biological integrity. One study found over half the surveyed area had high sediment quality characterized by healthy benthic assemblages and low levels of sediment contamination and toxicity. The remaining areas showed evidence of significant stress in one or more of the sediment quality components. This study found the spatial extent of sediment contamination and toxicity in North Carolina to be much less compared to other U.S. coastal regions where similar studies were performed. However, additional studies, expanded study areas, and continuous monitoring is needed to ensure these trends continue. So all of these habitats together make the foundation for a healthy coastal ecosystem and a healthy fisheries. Monitoring for the understanding of status and trends is needed to determine current condition and assess changes over time. While some monitoring is currently efforts are currently happening, these efforts need to be unified and expanded, and existing data gaps need to be addressed. This data can be used to enhance protection and restoration decisions and support current and future management actions to ensure not only the long-term enhancement of these habitats, but also their long-term persistence in North Carolina. And as Ann said, we'll be bringing back the final in the fall, and a lot of the recommendations that will come out of this issue paper will involve kind of those unifying recommendations across some of these monitoring programs, as well as additional steps to fill some of those data gaps. And I will take any questions.
Okay, great presentation, Casey. Any questions of Casey? I do have one. I don't know if I heard this right. You're talking about the hard bottoms that were being sanded over, and there was a larger presence of fish there. Did I hear that correctly?
If I said it wrong, I'm sorry. No,
I might have just heard it wrong.
It's actually the inverse. It's when they're sanded, okay. It actually decreases the abundance.
Gotcha. Okay. That's, that made more sense, but I want to make sure.
Sorry. Okay. I might fumble on my words too much today. I'm sorry.
No, you did. You did great. You did great. Okay. Anything else from anybody? Very important topic, and I appreciate y'all's work on this.